As we get down to the discussion of 1 Corinthians chapter 11, as far as Paul's corrections for the Corinthians and they're abusing the Lord's Supper, he says this in 33 and 34, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, Therefore, my brethren, when ye come together to eat, wait for one another. That is the bottom line. He's not talking about eating in a church building, as some people sometimes believe and say. He's talking about eating in the church, that is the body of God's people, the individuals who are saved. He says, when it's time for an assembly, you wait. Now, just as, and we discussed this briefly, just as there are periods, for example, in Bible class, if we've had sometimes cases where there's bad weather, if it's bad weather, we might wait 5 minutes, we might wait 7 minutes, possibly we are going to wait 10 minutes. But if you're going to teach the class and you've only got 45 minutes to teach, can you wait 40 minutes before you start the class?
Probably not.
So there comes a point in time you have to say, we've waited long enough, we're going to start. It doesn't matter if we still got some people in the way, we'll be praying for their safety. And they are certainly free to join us when they get here, but we have to begin. But the Corinthians were not doing that, so Paul begins to correct them here and says, you have to use some common sense, you have to wait for one another. Then we pick up with this material in verse 34. If any man is hungry, let him eat at home, that your coming together be not in the judgment. And then finally, this key part, which brings us to really new material, and the rest will I set in order whensoever I come. When you look at that word, which is translated set in order, that is a single term that's found three times in this book. Paul used it back in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 17. He also used it in 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 14. And then we're going to see it in the last chapter, 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 1. Back in chapter 9 and verse 14, it is translated ordain. One source defined it as set in order or put in order. We don't know what all the church problems were, but Paul says there are some that if they're still existing, when I show up, what am I going to do? You're going to get it fixed when I show up. How does that work in a home? You think there's some moms that have ever done that?
Just wait till your dad.
That's it, isn't it? That's the magic line. Dad's at work, but when dad gets home, he's going to take care of this. That's kind of what Paul is telling the Corinthians. When this apostle shows up, if you are not willing to correct these issues, they're going to get fixed. You have to remember back in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 14, Paul still looked at these Christians, these Corinthians, as his beloved children. It wasn't that he wanted to be harsh. It wasn't that he wanted to be unkind. It wasn't that he wanted to be mean. But these were issues. These were serious problems that if people would not self-correct, then Paul said, I will step in. Anything that you want to add or ask about that? That closes out 1 Corinthians 11 for us. So we're going to do, Lord willing, two things for the rest of the class. I want to give you a little insight as far as 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14. And then because we're about to deal with the subject of worship, in those three chapters, we want to have a little study on worship that will be for tonight's class, as well as some information next week. When you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 12, anybody know what one of the big topics is in that chapter? Very good. Paul's going to talk about spiritual gifts. Now, if he's talking about spiritual gifts in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, when you get to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, what might you be wondering or asking? If this is the subject here in 1 Corinthians 12, and remember there are no chapter and verse divisions in the Bible. If this is in 1 Corinthians 12 what he's talking about, then when we get into 1 Corinthians 13, what's a very logical question? Are we dealing with a... All right, is it a different topic or is it a continuation? A lot of people never ask that question. If you don't ask that question, you can have some very quick assumptions made and oftentimes some very wrong assumptions. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul's going to talk about spiritual gifts. This is in verses 1 through 11 as far as the variety, the diversity of gifts. And then he's going to talk about how those gifts relate to unity. Now, doesn't that make sense in light of what we've seen in 1 Corinthians chapter 11? The supper was designed to unify God's people. If you've spent all that time talking about that, you might want to spend a little additional time talking about that. And how interesting that you spend not only some additional time talking about that, but you spend some additional time talking about that while also dealing with another big issue at the church. So it's kind of clever how he weaves this information together. Then as you move forward a little bit in the 1 Corinthians 12, spiritual gifts, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, what do you think we have there? Don't disappoint me. All right, we've got the love chapter, right? Now, if you know that 1 Corinthians chapter 11 is a continuation of 1 Corinthians chapter 12, or 12 is a continuation of 11. They're wrapped together. Just kind of, in your mind, eliminate any wall or chapter division. If those two chapters are kind of one chapter, so to speak, They flow together. Then when you go from chapter 12 to chapter 13, do you think you might want to ask the same question? Is this also a continuation, or is this a brand new subject? If you ask that question and you study the text, you'd find that that is a continuation. If it is a continuation from 11 to 12, and it is a continuation from 12 to 13, then guess what? When you get over to 1 Corinthians chapter 14, is it a continuation or is it a completely different subject? It is a continuation, and hopefully we'll be able to tie all those things together. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, he shows the duration of spiritual gifts. He shows how those gifts were related to true love. I'm not saying that the qualities of love are a side point, but he didn't write the chapter just to tell us about love. There's more to it, and that would be the spiritual gifts. Then in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, he's going to talk about how those gifts were related to worship. Once again, you can see that is connected to what you had back there in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, right? He was talking about worship here with the Lord's Supper. He continues to talk about worship, but just from the standpoint of the spiritual gifts, and he regulates those gifts in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. It looks to me, especially as you look at this new section of the Corinthian letter, that some of the worship at Corinth was chaotic. We're going to see some indications that people claimed to say this or that, and they affirmed that they were being led to make those statements by guidance from the Holy Spirit. Do people do that today? Yeah. And that shouldn't surprise us. If they were doing this kind of thing 2,000 years ago in the Lord's church, there were some people doing that. Then, of course, we would expect that today, especially in the denominational realm. So you kind of see that from 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 3. You have another problem, and this, of course, involved the tongue speaking. The Corinthians took that gift of tongues, from what we can tell, and where did they place that gift compared to the other gifts?
The gift of tongues.
Yeah, that is the gift to have. Where, though, does the Bible place the gift of tongues? It's not at the top, it's at the bottom. Do people sometimes misprioritize things today? How do they do that? What should be really important is at the bottom of the list.
They put little things affect them first.
Yeah.
So they don't do the important things.
Yeah. I've confessed before to watching Cops. Before I go to bed, sometimes I just like to watch Cops for a little while. I'm thinking, how dumb can you be? And one of the things that I see oftentimes is a person, a female, 20s, 30s, who's arrested for drugs. And invariably, if she's a mom, what's she going to do? She's going to appeal based on her
children.
And she's going to say something to this effect. What's she going to say? There's nothing more important to me than my kids, right?
Don't take my kids.
Don't take my kids. It's always about the kids. And I am thinking, how can you say that? That seems to be an absolute lie. Because what was your priority? The drugs. They matter to you more than anything else. They matter to you more than your freedom. They matter to you more than your money. They matter to you more than your house. They matter to you more than a criminal-free record. All those things, that's where your priority was. Where are your kids? They're down here. Now, you can tell me your priorities are this, but your life is telling me your priorities are this. And that's what the Corinthians were doing when it comes to these spiritual gifts. They said, we've got the gift of tongues, but Paul says, you've got it upside down. And I'm going to have to correct that. And if you're not willing to fix that, as we see at the end of 1 Corinthians chapter 11, I'm going to come and I'm going to help you out. Another thing that we see is that the Corinthians seem to forget that the gifts were interconnected. And that's where we're going to get into this head and body illustration of 1 Corinthians chapter 11. People can sometimes undervalue their role. People can sometimes forget their role in life. People can sometimes not understand their role in life. And the Corinthians got things really mixed up. They had a lot of spiritual gifts, but and I'm sure that they were taught well, but things just really got out of control. Then, of course, we had this issue in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 that there was a lack of love. They failed to combine their gifts with love. When you start trying, I'll stop there and see if there's anything you want to add or ask. Anybody? Okay. When you start looking at the causes, and you'll see this in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, I think when Paul talks about love, one of the problems at the Corinthian church was rivalry. There was competition, there was jealousy, and those things help create and sustain the splits and the cliques that we started to read about in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. We've already seen that a little bit in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. If you are not willing to wait for people who need food, and you bring food and you eat food with other Christians, and you cheat the people who are probably not getting one decent meal a week, you have a serious problem. And that is also seen when it comes to the spiritual gifts. There was rivalry apparently over those gifts. They became competitive about the gift that they possessed, or the gifts, perhaps some had more than one, and it looked like the more flamboyant gift, then of course, the higher the Corinthians prized that particular gift. Do you think that there are problems today when there's competitiveness in the church? People try to compete? Can there be competition in a local congregation? I want to teach better than him. I want to teach better than her. I want to pray better than him. I want to pray better than her. I want to do this better. I want to do that better. When that happens, that's a problem. It not only creates problems in a local congregation, but that also is displeasing to God. It can happen as well. Do you think that there can be competitiveness between congregations in an area? There can be, and there is sometimes. Do you think that there can be competitiveness when it comes to preachers? No. There is, sometimes. Do you want to share or not?
It's a long story, another day.
Okay, all right. I always give people that opportunity, and if they say another day, then that's perfectly fine. Okay, let's see what else we've got here. Anything else that you wanted to perhaps discuss before we start talking about worship? Brian?
I mentioned the emphasis of spiritual gifts, the cessationist view of things, they aren't directly relevant to us. What would you hope that we would gain from the study of 12, 13, 14?
Well, I think you've got kind of the overriding point there would be some thoughts about worship that we can draw out for us. There are some principles that are always going to be eternal principles when it comes to worship. You can look at the gifts and talk about their function. How God has today said that we still need that information. We're going to get it in a different form. You can look at some other things as far as the decent and orderly principle that we have there. We have sometimes some different problems as far as the reason for chaos. So we have to turn things around a little bit, but worship, I think, is the main point that I would take from that. Okay, let's talk about worship a little bit more. Worship is something that's been around for a long time. You read about it as early as Genesis chapter 4 and verse 3. Man has always, it seems like, had a desire to worship someone or something. Some point back to Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11. I think that's a pretty good verse. That text says, God has set eternity in their heart. Eternity is built into the heart. Eternity is somehow in our DNA. There is this desire for God. There is this reaching for God. There is this desire to somehow serve him. Now, what does that mean? Do we take some animal and go to some mountaintop and sacrifice it? Do we build a fire and, you know, throw some kind of aroma on there and hope that there's some God that, you know, hears that, has that? Without revelation, we really don't know how to respond to that desire, but that does seem to be a desire, and we can quench that, we can deny that, but that is in the hearts of a lot of people. Do you remember Acts chapter 17 and verse 23? Paul showed up and he said, you worship what kind of gods? You worship the gods which you don't know? Anybody remember that? You worship these unknown gods? So man has that natural desire to worship, and he's the only creature on the earth who has the privilege of worship. You don't see the hippopotamus worshiping, the alligator worshiping, the ostrich worshiping, but man is the one that is in that role. There are a lot of people who have worshiped him, and as you look at human history and certainly the Bible, you find that people have worshiped him in different ways. We have before Moses and the Old Testament comes along, it seems like Adam worshiped him. You've got Eve. Also back there with him, obviously, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they worshipped under the patriarchal system. You've got that expressed in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 1. I cited in a recent lesson, Hosea chapter 6 and verse 7, the Bible says there that God had a covenant with Adam. Now that's an interesting thought, because if God has a covenant with people, what would you expect would be part of that covenant because of who God is? If there is a covenant with God, do you think worship might be associated with that? Old Testament it was. New Testament it is. So if there was a covenant with Adam, I'm thinking that's maybe the strongest proof, strongest indication that we have that worship was also somehow discussed, kind of like what you have back there in Genesis chapter 4. We do know, of course, that after the Hebrew people were freed from Egyptian bondage, there was that new system of worship that was given. Moses, Joshua, Samuel, Saul, David, Solomon, the Hebrew people, prophets, Jesus, and for a time, even the apostles worshipped under the Old Testament system. Jeremiah, though, in Jeremiah 31 and verse 31, said that the days were going to come where there would be a new system. And part of that new system was going to involve a new system of worship. Jesus, you may remember Matthew 26 and verse 28, we sometimes have that read before the Lord's Supper is eaten. Jesus said that there was going to be this new agreement that was going to be inaugurated, and that would be instituted by his blood. Paul explained that in slightly different terms. He said in Colossians 2 and verse 14 that Jesus' blood, it took that Old Testament system and it nailed it to the cross. That old way of worship is gone. And now, of course, we have the New Testament. You have in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 19, Paul says that that Old Testament system, which included the worship, was to last until the seed came. Anybody remember from Galatians 3 and verse 16 who or what that seed is? The seed is going to change things. Who's the seed? Jesus. He has come. The Old Testament has been removed. Paul used the illustration in Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 4, of a woman being married to a man. As long as it's a one man, one woman relationship, everything is good. But what happens if while that man is married to that woman decides to go out and get married to a second guy? She's got two husbands. Is that okay or is that a problem? One woman, two guys. Is that good or bad? Or we don't know.
Bad.
All right, it's bad. It's wrong, right? God says you can't have that. If you are one man, you got to be married to one lady. Fine. Then he says, here's what we're talking about now. It's not really about marriage. He says, you were married to a law. What law? The Old Testament. All right. If you were married to the Old Testament and you decide to keep that quote-unquote husband and you go out and you get married to a second husband, which is a second law, you're just like a woman who's married to two guys. If that's wrong in the secular realm, then it must also be wrong in the spiritual realm. And if it's wrong, it has to be one man, one woman, one religious person, and one religious system. Then the one religious system you need is what? New Testament or old? It's the new, and you don't use the Old Testament for justification and salvation. We can learn from the Old Testament, Romans 15 and verse 4, but as Paul said in Romans 10, 4, Christ is the end of the law unto righteousness to everybody that believes. We have to follow the New Testament. Anything that you want to discuss or explore on that? All right, let's move down a little bit more. God has always regulated man's worship. When you go back and you look at the Old Testament law that was given to the nation of Israel, God made sure that what the people needed, they had. Can you imagine the stuff, and we've seen some of this as far as pictures, maybe within the last year, Old Testament lessons, picked up some of the pictures from the tabernacle. If you kind of think back on some of the graphics I used, it was ornate. It was expensive. If you have some jewelry, maybe you have a family heirloom, or maybe you want to have a special ring made for somebody, do you just take that down to Joe the Body Man? Say, you got tools. Here's my diamond. Just go ahead and get out your welding in it. Let's see how well you do. Nobody does that. Who do you take that stuff to, Steve?
Somebody who's an expert in that
particular thing. You know, you need some people who have been trained. You need some people who have some understanding of, you know, the finer art of craftsmanship when it comes to jewelry. That's what God did in the Old Testament. He gave people special abilities. He gave them special insights. He provided everything that they needed for all the things that were going to be associated with Old Testament worship. Well, if God did that under the Old Testament, what would you expect with the New Testament, which is a vastly superior testament? If he fully equipped you here for the inferior, when it comes to the superior, what do you think he did? He'd give you at least as much, likely a lot more. And that's what we're going to be reading about in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, 13, and 14. A lot of that involved people who are apostles, prophets, and the spiritual gifts. You may remember, too, that he did that not only to equip the church, but to demonstrate the fact that the Christian faith is the one faith that the world is supposed to believe. Can you imagine how hard it would have been to introduce a brand new religion into a world? I mean, even today, it takes a while, doesn't it? If you are going to introduce, let's say that you want to introduce a new soap. You've devised what you think is a really good soap. How are you going to convince people to buy your soap? I don't know. I didn't check out this illustration in advance, but how many soap brands do you think are out there in the market right now? I'm thinking bars of soap that you have in a shower or by a sink.
Hundreds.
Yeah, I'm thinking we're definitely over 100 plus. All right, so you decide you want to be the new soap king. How are you going to do that? Yeah, it's going to be tough though, right? You've got plenty of competition. You've got soap companies that have been around for literally decades, maybe 100 or more years. It's going to be tough to break into the market. If you want to break into the religious world, you've got paganism. They've got all kinds of stuff. You know, sex sells today. Sex was used back then. Common. You know, people liked a lot of the stuff that was associated with it. You've got religion that's tied in with the business world. You've got, for example, in the first century of the Roman Empire, they had kind of cornered the market on religion. How are you going to bust into that market? Are you going to take about a dozen guys and send them out in the world and say, hey, we got this new religion. Listen to us. No internet, no TV, no radio, no newspaper. I don't know about you, but if somebody said, hey, I want to sign you up to do this job, I'd be thinking, not me, buddy. That is a losing proposition. Doesn't matter how much you're going to pay or the benefits. There's no way that's going to work. So what did God need to do? He needed to equip his people. And that's what he did. He did it under the Old Testament, and he did it under the New. He said, I'm going to give you a system, and I'm going to give you these tools. Imagine meeting somebody, or you go into a marketplace, and you see this person who's just like a computer. There are 20 different languages, and this person can speak them all, can communicate with them all. What would you think about a person like that? Absolutely fluent in 20 languages. What would you be wondering?
Did you ask what would you think of
them? Yeah, if you met somebody like that, what questions would go through your mind?
How much
and
where did you study?
Yeah, how did you learn that? I mean, are you just super smart? Were you trained in these? Is that your job? That's not something that we expect. And then if you can meet several people who have that ability, it's where'd you people come from? That's not normal. If you were a Christian, what would your answer be? The God I serve gave me this ability. Oh, wow, I didn't see that coming. I mean, you could tell me that you went to University X, and okay, that's understandable, that's believable. It took me 20 years to learn all these languages. Well, okay, you know, you must be super smart. You really, you know, we can kind of understand that. But you imagine somebody saying that. Or you imagine somebody who says, I've got somebody who's sick. Spent all my money on the doctors, and there's no help. There's no cure. Could I come see him? Are you a doctor? Nope. I'd just like to come see him. Okay. You mind if I touch him? Okay. In the name of Jesus, be healed. I'm well. How would you respond? You don't need to go on TV with your soap commercial now, do you? I mean, you've got that house, a cheerleader in your corner forever. They're going to be going and telling their neighbors, hey, this guy healed our family member. We went to all the doctors. We spent all the money. That can't be true. Look at him. He's out there playing in the street. So these gifts that we're reading about, it set the world on fire. And these were just two. Chris?
It's really interesting in Acts 2 that where they're from is actually in favor of the argument that God was behind it, because they even say, aren't these guys from Galilee?
Yeah.
Like, that's like the backwater country cousins of the city people. There's no way anybody would know more than one language in Galilee. You may know potentially 20. Like, how much sense does that make? There's got to be something else.
Yeah, you're exactly right, and that's a perfect illustration. It would be like somebody today going to the United Nations, and they just begin to address whoever it is. It's, oh, you got a secret earpiece. No. You can check me out. I've just got this gift. And how does that work? Even in today's world, that would be beyond amazing. Anybody else? All right, let's talk about some things when it comes to worship, as far as some facts, some simple facts about worship. We know from Matthew chapter 4 and verse 10 that worship is to be offered to God alone. Jesus made that point. God is spirit, John 4 and verse 24, so humans are not allowed to worship him with material objects, such as images. We see that in places like Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 12. When we think about worship, did Jesus accept it? Did Jesus accept worship? He did. But what do we just say from Matthew 4 and verse 10? Only who is authorized to accept worship?
Jehovah.
God, Jehovah. All right, if that's true, Jesus says that's right. and Jesus accepted worship, what's the conclusion? Jesus is God. So that's kind of some easy logic, but that's very, very forceful. When you think about some other things, it is to be offered with sincerity. Truth, of course, is obviously going to be part of that. The Corinthians apparently didn't do too well with that sometimes. They really got distracted. We talked about that as well. Jesus, when he talked about worship, Matthew chapter 15, 7 through 9, he says, don't be a hypocrite when it comes to worship. It is possible to be a hypocrite in worship. God doesn't look too favorably upon that. What else did Jesus say, Matthew chapter 6, verses 1 through about 6? Were there some people in his day and time who worshiped for show? They wanted to put on a performance? Yes, that's true. There were some people who put on a show when it came to giving. There were some people who put on a show when it came to things like praying. There were some people who put on airs, those kinds of things. You have, for example, in Luke chapter 18, remember the guy who goes to the temple? God, I thank you that what? I'm not like the rest of people. Do you think God knew what he was going to say? It wasn't for God's benefit. It was for the benefit of other people. There is that prescribed procedure of worship. That's the truth. Doing that according to God's word. All right. When you go back to the book of Psalms, and you can find this elsewhere, Psalm 100 and verse 3, worship is about honoring God. People who are ignorant sometimes, and even selfish, will make worship about themselves. One came up with this, which I like. In some places, worship seems to be how great we are instead of how great thou art. God's not going to look kindly on that. When you think about Psalm chapter 95, verses 6 and 7, another passage which talks about honoring God because of who he is. That verse says, O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before Jehovah our Maker, for he is our God. We are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. Today, oh, that ye would hear his voice. Another passage which helps us with Old Testament worship is Deuteronomy 16 and verse 16. Three times in a year, God says, shall all the males appear before Jehovah thy God in the place which he shall choose, in the feast of unleavened bread, and the feast of weeks, and the feast of tabernacles, and they shall not appear before Jehovah empty. When it comes to worship, it is to be a giving experience. Do you think, though, that when it comes to worship, there are people who have more of a receiving attitude? Okay, we'll start with you, Sherman.
I think it goes both ways.
Yes, biblically it should. But when we think about the person who has the greater emphasis on receiving, let's put it that way, what do you often find there as far as the thinking?
Depends on what they're seeking.
Yes. You're taking us a little further down the road. We just need to go a little further. I went to worship today.
They did not.
What's that next key word?
I didn't receive what I needed.
Okay, receive a word. I didn't get anything out of it.
Right.
That's that key word. I didn't get. Well, now, from one perspective, could that be true and okay? That could be correct. I mean, it's possible that some things happen. For whatever reason, maybe no fault of the worshiper, that, hey, that was just not a real good worship experience for me. But a lot of times, and I would think it's fair to say that most of the time, if somebody makes that statement, what's kind of going on inside?
They're not putting anything into it.
Yeah. And it's not that they make that statement once, but it's going to be a habitual thing. Typically, a person will get to a point where what's the end result for them? They start out, I didn't get anything out of it today. And then 6 months later, a year later, what's true of that person?
They're making an excuse and dropping out.
Yeah, they're no longer there. And if you talk to them, what are you going to hear? I went, I didn't get anything out of it, and I'm done. That person either was never taught, or that person never realized that worship is not so much, I mean, we should get some things out of it. What could we get out of worship? Or class, hopefully. All right, now, if you're a person who is a serious Bible student, if you are a person who hopefully is a preacher, you can sit through, Chris, we'll just put you on the spot here since you're a preacher. If you sit through a lot of Bible classes, do you think that there's probably going to be a lot of stuff that's said that you already know?
Sure.
Do you think it's fair to say that compared to a lot of people, as you sit through a Bible class, there's probably going to be a lot that you quote-unquote don't learn that's brand new? That's the same question in a different form.
Yeah, I was trying.
Okay, I wasn't trying to trip you up. Very good. All right, so, but even though you might know a lot of stuff, you can still benefit, right? It's nice sometimes to have old truths reaffirmed. It's nice to be reminded of some texts. You might see some things in different ways. You might come up with some illustrations. There might be a verse that's brought to mind that you're looking at something else, dealing with another circumstance, and say, hey, that verse really wasn't on my mind, but now I can kind of connect that to this. And this is useful for me. So when people say, I don't get anything out of that, that's really kind of a stretch. What should we get out of worship in class? Hopefully some knowledge. What else?
Encouragement.
Yeah, hopefully we do. What else?
Community.
Yeah, there's that sense of fellowship, togetherness, community, unity, hopefully. Anything else? What do we get? It was good to be here. As you read about in the Old Testament, I was glad when they said, let's go up to the house of the Lord. So it is a good thing. You know, sometimes you could ask that same question. I read the other day from a little Amish Mennonite publication I get, there was a family that moved into a community. They did something that I have never seen anybody do before. They decided to just raise their garage door up one day and put out some food, and go knock doors and say to their neighbors, come on over. And a lot of people did. What do you think they got out of that? Well, probably not a lot, but they did get to meet their neighbors. They did get to communicate, hey, we're friendly, we'd like to see you. So there wasn't anything major. I mean, there was nothing financial about that. There was nothing that bettered their health. It did cost them perhaps a little time, maybe a little money for food, those kinds of things. But sometimes it's just good to have those experiences. And there's nothing more important than coming together and checking out God's word and will. Okay, a couple of passages there that we can tie in with that. You think about the wise men who came to see Jesus. Would you say that they came more to give or get? Give. And they offered a lot as far as the distance that they came. So we may not have the gold, the incense, the other things that those men have, but we can offer our heart, our will, our worship, and our life to God. All right, anything else? We got about 8 minutes left, so let's tie in a couple of the things here. When you think about the worship that you offer to God, that does require intent. You see that in a lot of passages, oftentimes in the Old Testament, but certainly in the New as well. If we're going to glorify God with good works, there's intent there, but also that is true when it comes to worship. One of the first places that you see that in the Old Testament is Genesis chapter 22 and verse 5. Remember, Abraham said to his servants, you guys stay here, I'm going to take my son, and we're going to go over to this place to what? To worship. That described a plan, that described an intent, and that is a good way to illustrate that worship does require those kinds of things. You also see this illustrated, Joshua chapter 5 and verse 14. The people who came to see Jesus that we talked about a minute ago, Matthew 2 and verse 2. What about the eunuch? Would you say that he had to have intent when he went to worship in Jerusalem? He had a long distance to go. So he had the intent. He had the intent to go back home. Sometimes, though, people don't always associate worship with intent. This idea comes up from time to time. You may or may not have heard it. I've seen it a few times over the years since becoming a Christian. You will hear occasionally people say, everything you do is worship. Back in the day when people were talking about that, questions were sometimes raised as like this. Would you say that brushing your teeth is worship? Well, sure it is. If all life is worship, then brushing your teeth, taking out the garbage is worship. Washing the dishes, that's worship. Well, that really doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, are you telling me that washing the dishes, cleaning the table, that's on par with singing hymns to God and having the Lord's Supper and doing the other things that we have at worship? People have tried to maybe adjust that a little bit and say, well, you know, that's kind of big worship and this is little worship, but it really doesn't wash when you look at the passages that we have when it talks about intent. Anything that you want to add or ask on that? Okay, quiet class tonight. Let's see what else we've got. If worship is something that requires purpose and action, we should never see it as a spectator sport or performance. But sometimes when you think about worship, people come to be entertained. Anybody ever talk to a friend who kind of saw worship in that way? They say, we like the experience there. Do you think they were telling you the truth? Well, sure. I'm absolutely positive that's why they went. But that's not really what you find in the Bible. Now, who wants to go to a place where worship is an unpleasant experience? No. If it feels like you're going to go to the dentist and have a tooth pulled every time, I don't know that that's going to be a big incentive. That's probably not going to be a huge draw for a lot of people. So we do want to have that togetherness. We do want to have that unity. We do want that to be a good experience. But some people have taken that way too far, and they're thinking that worship is something to be done for them. It's some kind of performance. They're going to sit back and judge it, and that's wrong. We did have some issues with that. I suspect that there are still several places that are still going through that because of COVID. It was very convenient for a lot of people when we were doing the Zoom thing all across the nation and probably across the world. We'll just stay at home and have a Zoom call and worship in our pajamas. For a lot of people, that was a brand new experience. I had never worshiped from my office before in a corporate sense. And I don't think too many other people had as well, unless they'd been maybe a nursing home, something like that. Maybe watching through Facebook, those kinds of things. But people do that. You also have this kind of thing, and be wary of this as well. Do you think that there's some Christians who kind of rate worship? Rate, R-A-T-E, like you would rate a movie. You think anybody does that? Man, that guy who led the prayer today, what might somebody say about him? I never thought he was going to finish. You think anybody's ever said that? Right. They have. Well, how should we view that? I mean, if a guy prayed for 15 minutes, or imagine somebody prays for 30 minutes, half the service. Preacher says, I cut it short because the guy prayed so long. That's probably not a good thing to say, but he could. So what do you do? How do you think about that? Well, let's help you out a little bit. Oh, Steve.
Well, that is unusual, but you try to see the positives in that.
Yeah.
What did he talk? What was that prayer about? This has been about a lot of things that we talked that long, unless you were very repetitive. Even so, you focus on what the prayer was about.
Yeah. Is a 30-minute prayer wrong? No. Nick?
It's unlikely that anybody could follow prayer that long.
It would not probably be the best judgment. It's certainly not in our country, maybe in some other place. So it's easy to be critical of things, and there are legitimate observations. That would be one. That in our culture, if somebody is going to lead a prayer, especially if you're asking people to stand, singing might be a better illustration of their people, and song leaders do that for different reasons. Sometimes people benefit from stretching the legs. If you're going to sing stand up for Jesus, and you got people sitting down, that just doesn't quite seem to harmonize too well. But when you think about doing some things, as far as what we're looking at here, we really want to be careful when it comes to quote-unquote rating people. Do you think that people, if they're trying to help out in worship service, they want to get up and think, let's see how I can mess this up. Can I figure out how to do this in the worst possible way? People don't think that. They want to do what? They want to do the best they can. So if somebody gets up and drops a communion tray, well, guess what?
It happens.
All right, yeah, it happens. I don't think I've ever seen that here. I've seen people mix up the communion. But again, as Steve mentioned, you think through those things. Be careful about judging. It could be you. And if it were you, you might have done worse. All right, let's see if there's anything else that we've got here with a couple minutes left. I'll give you this quote because I like it too. Americans worship their work. They work at their play, and they play at their worship. That's true in some places. We do not want that to be true for us. Another said, and I like the quote, Sunday has been turned into fun day. That's also something that happens in a lot of places. We do not want that to be true here or the place we worship. If worship becomes entertainment or performance, it is no longer worship. And remember 1 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul says, if you are fouling up the Lord's Supper, and this was not once, this was not twice, we saw all the present tense, all the continuous verbs. He says, if this is something that you do again and again and again, you drink what? You drink judgment unto yourself. God is going to notice, and God is going to act in a way where things don't work out very well. Okay, you've got some people who have tried to think that they knew better. Leviticus chapter 10, verses 1 and 2, those two priests, Nadab and Abihu, God struck them because they did not do things in the right way. He's not doing that today as far as striking people dead in worship, but that still doesn't mean that we are free to kind of do what we want. All right, final observation before we shut it down there for now.